Oh, thank you for coming out when you could well be sleeping. As I could too, actually, if you hadn't come. But today's talk is one that I have given very many times. But it was also a turning point for me. Abortion is a major issue. It will be in the next election, as it has been in previous elections. And I was pro-choice for 20 years. Over rubella babies, basically. In the early 60s, I was doing medicine in London. We didn't have a rubella vaccine. And every now and again, one would see a mother who was pregnant and she had a rash. And she would say, "Is this rubella?" To which the answer is, "Could be." Or sometimes, "No, that's not rubella." But rarely, usually you had to say, "Could be." "We need to take some blood today. Some more in 10 days' time, and I'll see you 2 days later, and we'll sort it all out." Now, in most cases, of course, you were able to reassure and say, don't worry, you don't have a problem. But before the vaccine came along, women knew that rubella at certain times in pregnancy was very bad news. So what I was a resident at that stage, what we were taught to say, if it was bad news, is, "This pregnancy's gone wrong, hasn't it?" To which they would say, "Yes." "Would you like to start again?" To which they would say, "Yes, again." Abortion was actually strictly illegal, but I said, the next thing that I would say is, "We can make that happen. You just have to come into hospital briefly." Of course, it occurred on the OR list simply as a DNC. Now, the important point to make is that I felt no guilt at that point. Note the verb, though, felt. I didn't think about it at all. I'd been already conditioned into seeing medicine as a problem-solving activity. Here was a woman who was very anxious, and after the abortion was over, she was not anxious about having a severely handicapped child. I didn't even think whether she might have other anxieties as a result of this. And it was going to be 20 years before I thought about it. I can be very insensitive at any time, but over this issue, I was extremely insensitive. When we got pregnant, the guy I chose to deliver our first two babies was in the British system a senior resident, who's about 5 to 10 years more experienced than a senior resident in the American system. They're just waiting for their consultant position. He was very, very good, and everybody knew it, and he was a Christian. When he delivered our babies, abortion was not an issue because it was illegal. He didn't have to do it. Although he was to find out in the next few years, and I took no notice, too bound up in my own career. He didn't get the job he should have had. Sometimes he was overqualified. Sometimes he was underqualified. But basically what was going on is, abortion had been legalized. There are only a few doctors who actually like doing abortions, and there's something wrong with their psyche. Most people cannot do that job and not be changed by it themselves. And they do not like what they do. And so if they appoint to the staff at the hospital in the British system somebody who doesn't do abortions, what does that mean? The ones who did the appointing have to do more. So you don't get appointed. That's what happened to Peter. He ended up doing family practice with an interest in obstetrics. He should have been a top-flight obstetrician, gynecologist. But he gave that up rather than pollute his conscience. I didn't think about it for 20 years. Sally, I think, was actually away at the time, probably in Africa. And God was getting to work on me in all sorts of different ways. And one afternoon, I didn't feel like working in the laboratory. So I said to my, I'm going to my office, don't disturb me. And I sat down, and for the first time in my life, I asked myself the question, okay, I bought the feminist argument that men should say nothing about abortion because it's a woman's issue. But okay, I can feel what they're saying, but can I think it? By the end of the afternoon, I knew that I couldn't. Furthermore, I knew that the way it had come to me, I didn't think anybody could resist the argument. I was not actually happy about that. The last thing I wanted to do was to get into this can of worms. And I didn't say anything to anybody except Robert Spitzer. I actually called him and talked to him and said, look, I've been thinking about abortion. He's, of course, pro-life. An evangelical Jesuit, if you can imagine such a thing. And he said, that will work, you know. And I said, that wasn't what I wanted you to say. But I didn't worry about it. I didn't tell anyone. But as usual, my wife, not knowing what she was doing at the time in one sense, said, people come, call me, tell me that they wish they'd known where you were because they would have driven to get there. And she said, I can't know where everybody lives, so you're going to have a website. And I said, well, that's a waste of time. But it wasn't. A lot of people go there. But most importantly, of course, students, when they're bored in lectures, start surfing the web, and I was on that list of places they serve. So not long after she set the website up, I got a call from Detroit, from Wayne State, the black medical school, basically. And they said, we see you're going to Ann Arbor. You live in Ottawa. You have to go through Windsor or Detroit to get there. Will you speak to us first? And I said, sure, what do you want me to talk about? And then they pointed out the date, January the 23rd, the Roe v. Wade decision. And they said, we want you to talk about abortion in the medical school in the middle of the day. Now, how many of you would volunteer for that? Certainly, I didn't wish to do it. I said, no, I don't do that lecture. And they said, we've heard you talk. We think you could do it. And I said, flattery will get you nowhere. And then they did the Christian thing. We've been praying about it. Now, I knew deep down that this was going to happen. I was not looking forward to it, I must confess. So I said, as long as it's in a lecture theatre with an escape door by the lectern and you drive me to Ann Arbor immediately afterwards, I'll do it. So I did. To my astonishment, the lecture ended in total silence. Nobody was asleep. They were just stunned. So was I. And that's what's happened every time since. So the talk I'm about to give in one form or another has been given at Harvard, at Wisconsin, at Oxford, St. Petersburg, Sydney, Berkeley, you name it. I've never had a single aggressive question at the end of it, which is stunning. The whole question, as usual, with anything, when you're discussing a subject like this, the first thing is to frame it correctly. And we don't usually do that. The way that I frame it, and it works, a little ironic humour helps, but most of the time it's been to medical students, not entirely, but most of the time it's been medical students, medical groups, always with a significant medical student group. So if it's not entirely medical students, I say to the others, you can just watch this first few questions. It's the medical students I want to talk to primarily at this point. And I begin by saying, I don't know any of you, but if I was to say that within 6 weeks of starting medical school, you decided there were people in your class to whom you would never trust the care of a dog of yours, what would you say? And that elicits wry smiles throughout the whole population. The answer is yes. Very clearly, yes. And it's got much more yes over the years. I say, I see your answer. Now, if I asked you the next question, it would be, if we took a consensus vote in your class about who these people are that you will not trust to the care of the dog of yours, would they be agreeant about that too? And the answer is yes again. And I say, that's very interesting, isn't it? Now, what we're discussing today is the question of what, if any, duties do we owe to the human creature before it's born? Now, that is a moral discussion, whether you like it or not, because it's about duties and ought. I presume those people you don't trust at all are not actually here at the moment. And they're not. They're not. So they're not immoral so much as amoral. They have not been properly formed, not properly educated. Now, the rest of you have been. So the next question goes a little further along the line. Those of you who remain, is there any possibility of agreement between you on issues of life and death and sexuality? And the answer, of course, is what? No. In fact, it's a 50-50 divide with a bit in favour of pro-choice. So, isn't that interesting? You are not considered unethical by your colleagues as long as we don't talk about these issues. And you return the compliment. So it looks to me as though the question actually is not abortion at all. The real question is, what would you need to believe in order to be an ethical abortionist? And what would you need to believe to be an ethical anti-abortionist? So let's start there. By this time you have their attention, and nobody's getting angry. They're, at this point they're intrigued, invariably. They just haven't thought about it this way. So I say, well, it's easy to do it in Canada, because the two, the main proponent of abortion in Canada is a man called, for most of my life, has been a man called Henry Morgenthaler. I believe he's dead now, I'm not certain of that, but I believe he is. Now, all you need to know about Henry Morgenthaler is that he was Jewish, and he lost all his family except one brother in Auschwitz. The other brother, actually, is an Orthodox Jew who's appalled at what Henry did. But Henry is a feminist, in the good sense of the word, and, or was. He thought that women should not be constrained by their biology, so that if they happened to get pregnant, and that was going to be in the way of a career, or just in the way of what they wanted to do, he should help them to do that. Now, he does not believe in God. Can you blame him after losing your family in Auschwitz? I wonder whether I would believe in certainly a God of love if I had endured that experience. When you're in that position, your default must be utilitarian ethics. That's all that's left to you. To put it rather crassly, the ethics of net happiness. Now, he's honest. He says he doesn't pretend he doesn't snuff out human lives. He's not intellectually dishonest to that degree. What he says is, when I see a woman come into my clinic wanting an abortion, I recognize there are two people here. Both of them ultimately without meaning, because he believes life ultimately has no meaning. You do what gives you pleasure, what gives you satisfaction. One of them is unhappy. The other one is not yet developed to the point of being able to be happy or unhappy. So when I have snuffed out the ultimately absurd life, I've done nothing to the net absurdity that's entered the world, but I've increased the amount of happiness in the world. Therefore, it is a good action. And that's where utilitarian ethics take you. It is. I don't wish to make ethics illegal because half our population do not believe the premises that would make it illegal. I do want to make it unthinkable. That's a very different objective. On the other hand, if put Mother Teresa by the bed. Now, she sees two lives, like Henry Morgenthaler, but one is now about to put her immortal soul in jeopardy. What's the ethical thing to do now? It's the exact opposite. So both groups are both rational and ethical. The trouble is we don't even agree about the nature of rationality on the larger scale. We agree about scientific rationality, but that's a subset of the whole of rationality. It's not the whole thing. The problem with the worst part of that spectrum is they think scientific rationality is capable of answering every question. It isn't. And the attempts they've made over the last 30 years make that very plain. They've got nowhere. Even unbelieving philosophers say, we're nowhere near a solution to this problem. I mean, McIntyre could write a book, Which Rationality, Whose Justice? And everybody knows it's a very good book. So that's where we're at. So what do we do? Well, I said, I usually say at this point, I hope that what I've achieved for you so far is to realize that it is the person who uses the word bigot in relation to the abortion issue who is actually the bigot. Because a bigot is someone who will not conceive of the possibility that they may be wrong. And we can't prove this either way, in a way that everybody has to accept. It's not available to us an option. So what do we do instead? Well, the only thing we've got left to do is to look at outcomes. Now, I have to acknowledge that at least at first sight rationality, if abortion is made illegal, then backstreet abortions ought to increase. The fact that there's no data for this is another question, which is not really for today, but there is no data. And in fact, if you're interested in that, the place to go is the Chile experiment of nature. Because under Allende, very liberal, very left-wing, abortion was freely available. Probably the only thing that Pinochet did that has some significance, from my point of view anyway, is that he did make abortion illegal. Then when he went, a liberal government came back, and abortion is back again. So they've done an experiment of nature for us. What actually happened was not what was expected. Maternal mortality rate actually went down during the Pinochet regime, and it went down at a significant rate. It's not an accident. It's statistically real. What that means, I think, is that many women who have abortions are pushed into it by the men who don't want to hear the word daddy. I think many women, when they get pregnant, they may have been pro-choice before, but the very fact of knowing that they are pregnant changes them. And so when it was illegal, they could say, I'm not going to do something illegal, I might end up in prison. That's worth knowing. It's an important consideration. But let's leave it with the immediate rationality of the materialist world and say it will increase backstreet abortions. Now, I hope none of you have ever seen one. Maybe one or two of you have. But in my day, before abortion was legal in Britain, you did see them. Now, of course, the normal way to die, if you can have a normal death under these circumstances, is septicemia and acute renal failure. It's not good news. It's a horrible way to die. No one should die that way. It was nowhere near the numbers that were fabricated in America. And of course, as usual, you don't apply your mind when you're actually in an argument with what's going on. I was doing nephrology. In 4 years in a nephrology unit, I never saw a case of acute renal failure from abortion. If the numbers were anywhere near what they said they were, that's not possible. They were nowhere near it. They did happen. I'd seen one in infectious disease. I'd never seen one in nephrology in 4 years in London. And of course, years later, we found out why. Nathanson, in his wonderful book, The Hand of God, I hope you've all read that. It's an amazing book, because he was brought from pro-choice to pro-life as a gynecologist, not by faith, but by science. The more he studied the development of the unborn baby, the more he said, this is the most inhumane thing you can do. This is a child. He didn't change his position till he was 60. And the book, The Hand of God, is an incredible book. You'll need a dictionary to read it. He's a highly intelligent man with a vocabulary which is much greater than mine. I needed a dictionary. It had in it one line which I will never forget. He was working at the Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago, which had a very high reputation. He went bankrupt later on for corrupt behavior, but he saw it coming. He said of the Michael Reese Hospital while he was there, he said, there I saw operations done with consummate skill on patients who did not need them. You all know about that. It happens everywhere. One thing that doing medicine does, it makes you very aware of the weaknesses of human nature. You can't avoid that. I saw it first in my surgical rotation as a first-year intern, and I was so shocked. I couldn't say anything. I didn't know what to say. Operations on people who shouldn't have had them. An amazing book to read. But Aquinas teaches us, and he's right, that when you are arguing about a contentious subject like this, always make the opposition's case for them better than they can do it, as honestly as you possibly can. That does a lot to defuse the situation. So I say, which is true, I don't want any woman to die of a septic abortion, especially in a society where the belief system which would make that abortion wrong is no longer widely accepted. I want it to be done properly. There are people who are willing to do it, and certainly looking after them afterwards, anyone would be prepared to do. I do sometimes, and depending on the audience, sometimes not, point out there's no data for my fear. The two countries in Europe with the lowest abortion rates for a long while, and the lowest maternal mortality rates, who were both opposed to abortion, Ireland and Poland. But of course, that's not a clean-cut experiment, because both Ireland and Poland have borders with countries that will do abortions, and presumably what really happened is people went over the border. But nevertheless, the data is there for what it's worth. So I have to admit that as a Christian, if we had rather aggressive pro-lifers, and they do exist who haven't thought their way through this, who want to stop it now, just like that, it would probably be disastrous in ways that would cost people their lives and therefore their souls no time to repent. I don't want that. But what about the other side? Nobody, as far as I can see to this day, has set it out in detail in book form. There are a few papers now. But it can be done. The first thing, and since I was around for the whole history, I've seen it happen. So it's very personal to me. The first thing that happened was that women who were persuaded that an abortion was a trivial event by the feminist movement had their abortion. And what did they say afterwards? It doesn't feel trivial to me. They didn't use those words. They were largely from the uneducated classes. They said, I feel as though I've killed my baby, which you don't get when you have a tooth out, which is the analogy they'd used. Now, a very clever woman called Annette Beyer realized that you couldn't argue with what they say about their feelings. You should never do that. They're their feelings, so you have to accept them at that level. We have to find ways to get around this. And she did it. Maybe even to some of you, is a human being and a human person the same thing to you? Raise your hand if it is. Or you nod, yeah, most of you. But not to bioethicists. Following Annette Beyer's work, they made that distinction. So if I'm debating with a clever feminist, she will immediately give me that human life begins at conception. There's no other place where you change your DNA. That's when you get your unique mixture. They won't even argue that. They say, yeah, that's a human being. It's not a human person. What Annette Beyer said, we need to define personhood in terms of function. That's clever. But it has a sting in the tail. So you become a human person. There's a whole raft of definitions that are discussed. The dominant one is probably you become a human person when you are capable of relationship. Now think about that for the moment, and you women don't look at the man next to you and wonder if you'll ever make it. But that's true, isn't it? It's a real problem. But it's you see what that means. Before we move to that definition, every human being had a right to exist. I came into the world before this happened as a little brat who knew they owed me. Nowadays, of course, all children know that, but they grow up pretty quickly. And then they realize a little later on, Mom wasn't sure she wanted me. What does that do to their psyche? It's got a lot to do with many of the troubles we have now. The person who first insisted that this is a really big problem was Ferguson from New Zealand, who's a pro-choice secularist, psychiatrist. But he said, I'm fed up. There are so many women coming into my clinic and their depression and anxiety can be clearly traced back to their abortion. It's a real problem. But of course, once you've accepted a functional definition, where do you draw the line? How much function? There are babies in utero who are more developed than babies with severe intellectual deficits. So where do you draw the line? Well, you know what the feminists did? They drew it at late-term abortion and then at infanticide. I remember Peter Crave saying to me when we were discussing this, he said, be careful of being very clear, because just a week or two before the conversation, he said, I was giving this kind of talk in Boston. And after the lecture, two girls came up to me and said, Professor Crave, thank you for that lecture. We were worried about infanticide, but now we see it's necessary. When you're committed to the conclusion, you will accept whatever's necessary to defend the conclusion. It's not easy to change people who are that far into a position. In fact, I don't think it's even worth trying. I don't bother. It needs more power than I've got. If it's going to be changed, it's going to be changed by the Holy Spirit. That, of course, also allows geriatricide, especially for things like Alzheimer's. And I mean, what if one of your children got a herpes simplex encephalitis and tomorrow morning woke up with an IQ of 30? Same argument applies. And we're moving in all these directions. It's all happening because it's logical. And as Budiszewski puts it beautifully in that lovely article in First Things a few years ago, The Revenge of Conscience, we're still logical, but slowly. The medieval monks were logical quickly. We're logical slowly. But logic is part of human nature. It will slowly work its way through. So the first domino to go down after you'd accepted choice and the fact that we don't have a shared moral rationality, the next one to go down is personhood and human beings. That has led to such things as Harris, who holds a chair in bioethics in Manchester, proposing the following, that the death rate waiting for transplants has now got to such a level that everybody waiting for a transplant should be not only cross-matched, but have measurements of the function of all their major organs, so that when the death rate on the waiting list reaches a level that's greater than the risk of transplantation, the computer should be asked to choose somebody on the list to be sacrificed, because they have five or six organs that can save five or six people. And he's serious. He's an academic who lives in a world of cloud cuckoo land, but he has a personal chair. People wonder why I have some doubts about the state of the university. And he's not alone. If you want a more complete description of what's going on in this area, just read Budiszewski's discussion in the early part of What We Can't Not Know. Budiszewski was pro-choice, became pro-life. He teaches government and philosophy at Austin. And I asked him about the journey when we met. And he said, well, I grew up in an evangelical home and went to university, studied politics and philosophy and sidelined my faith. I was hired by the University of Austin to develop a theory of government that did not require morality. He said, I only gave up because I realized that if I succeeded, I would have no reason to love my wife and children. It was his wife and children that stopped him in his tracks. And he came back first to an evangelical faith, and then being the man he is with an IQ somewhere around 200, I guess, he adopted natural law and found all his friends in the Catholic Church, so he's an evangelical Catholic now. He wrote for Focus on the Family briefly, but What We Can't Not Know is one of the most brilliant books I've ever read. It is, because it is lucid, anybody can understand it, and yet it is profound. He's giving you a picture of what goes on. He says, I'm probably the only professor of government who has all the works of Thomas Aquinas on his shelf. People don't argue with him. It's not worth the effort. We have many people like that on our side. So what's the next thing to go down? Exactly the area he was concerned about. It was illegal in the Western world, had been forever, to do abortion. Right back to the beginnings of common law in the 8th century. We'd never accepted it. Because in those days, we treated ordinary people's view of right and wrong as the starting point. It was assumed if it's been around that long, then you ought to assume that there's some strength to the argument. Nowadays, of course, clever academics don't accept that at all. They just want to make them look silly, which is terrible. I mean, it's not even courteous, let alone anything else. So now we've got to a stage where we were proposing, and we are now doing, the killing across the board. And in Canada now, we have legalized euthanasia. We know from the Dutch data that we should expect between 1 and 2,000 people to be killed every year without any evidence of consent, despite all the legal constraints. Holland is perhaps one of the most upright countries in Europe, morally, especially after the Second World War. Yet they were the first to do this. They've kept all the data. They've never actually prosecuted anybody for breaking the rules that were put in place. They've always found a way around that. And now you've got to the point where people are being killed because they're depressed. If they want to be killed, they say, I've had enough of depression. Your drugs don't work for me. Kill me. They do. It's got to a stage where last year I read of a professor in one part of Belgium getting a call from the other end of Belgium, and it was a nurse on the line, and she said, your mother asked for euthanasia this morning. We've done it. Will you please come and remove the body? That was the first he knew about it. If we should not be surprised. This is how it happened in the first place. In the 19th century, professors like me, who are dangerous people because we run off on side issues, discussing what we think might happen or possible, which you shouldn't do, over many issues. And we would say in lectures, because of Darwin and the like, you know, we're breeding better animals, that's undeniable. I mean, when I show pictures of a 2,000-pound bull on my farm in Africa, they don't believe me. They say that's fake news. No, it's not. That's what we can get them up to. And we were given some Victorian grapefruit bowls when we got married by Sally's great aunt. They only contain oranges these days. That's how much change has taken place over the years. So we are breeding better if you define better in utilitarian terms. And then go on, we ought to breed better people. Now the two words in that sentence that really need thought get no thought at all. What do you mean by better, and what do you mean by ought? The fact-value distinction is real. You cannot get from a factual statement to a moral injunction without cheating. Somewhere in the argument, when you take it to pieces, there's got to be the statement to save life is good. And that did not come from the facts. That came from some other place. And it's your job to think where it might be. For us, that's not difficult. The fact-value distinction that Hume brought to the fore, people try and dismiss it, but it's perfectly true. It happens. It's real. The way I usually demonstrate it is to take some victim that I know in the room as my example. Take Alan, for example. Imagine that Alan has cancer. And a few weeks ago in my laboratory, I invented a cure, or discovered a cure, for his cancer. Nobody knows this yet. I haven't said anything about it. Ought I to give him the cure? Now, only Marcia is on your side at the moment, so you've got some work to do. The rest just don't want to get caught in what they know is coming. But it ought to be yes immediately from all of you. But what if I'm a Darwinian? And what if I believe the world is really described by a battle of the genes? And Alan is a wealthy man, and it just so happens that I inherit his estate when he dies. What ought a Darwinian to do? The exact opposite. There's no individual altruism derivable from a Darwinian project. There was the Willie Hamilton way of doing it, but that was group altruism, and that's not the problem. The problem is that you jump in front of a book regardless of how many shared genes you have to rescue a child. And philosophers know that. A lot of pro-choice people immediately say that's not true, you know, it can be done. Because they believe Willie Hamilton simply because he got an obituary in Nature and Science, which, you know, lauded him to the skies without discussing the defects in his fancy paper with lots of unnecessary mathematics to hide the truth. But that's where we're at. So what happens next? Throughout human history, we've known that this is wrong, but it had to be legalized. Now, in your decision, the Roe v. Wade decision, it's particularly clear. Harry Blackmun spent a long time in the Mayo Clinic Library going through the stuff to make his case as far as he could. But the one dissenting judge, whose name I've forgotten, wrote very accurately, percipiently, you might say, that this judgment is not an act of law, but an act of raw judicial power. And he's right. That decision changed the nature of law in North America. It is now ambivalent at all levels. And three faculties in the modern Ivy League university, and in fact the state universities too, teach this in class. Black studies, women's studies, and homosexual studies all teach that the law is not about justice, it's about power. Now, I think I've already quoted to you this week Arthur Leff's discussion of this. You ought to have that on your phone, as I said at the time, because there's an atheist who sees this clearly and can write 20 pages of lucid prose showing why it's a real problem to which he has no answer. But it doesn't stop there. Now, it's afternoon and you need a little light relief. I was actually giving this lecture in Harvard. And the audience was not getting too angry. I was enjoying it. And then into my head popped something I hadn't done before. And I couldn't resist. I actually had the argument myself, you will be in enough trouble in this lecture without making it worse. But this was just too good to pass up, so I did it. One of the things that comes out of the abortion movement is, in fact, the animal rights movement. The number of activist women in the animal rights movement who've had an abortion is remarkably high. And the person who saw this coming was not a Christian, but one of Harvard's favorite sons, Robert Frost, who was a liberal, an arch-liberal, but also a good mind and an honest man. And many years ago, he wrote a wonderful poem called The White-Tailed Hornet. Now, he lived on a farm, as we do, in the Northeast, and every summer there are hornets' nests there. They're rather globular things like this. They're rather fine. My grandchildren, if they see them, like to throw stones at them, which is dangerous because hornets are quite aggressive and territorial, and they deserve what they get. But they don't bother about cows. Cows can munch away right underneath the nest. They won't bother them, but they're wary of us. And Robert Frost was interested in these insects, so he would watch them every year. And they're territorial. And this particular year, the first bit of the poem describes how he got too close and how he got stung. But the bit that came into my head was the next bit. He went back later, and on another day, he was watching a hornet, and it took three goes to realize that the irregularity in the barn wall was not edible. It was, in fact, the remains of a nail. And he realized he was surprised because he was anthropomorphizing the insect, which was just a bundle of reflexes. And it so happened that that nail, in some way, had set off a reflex chain. And so he wrote, "Won't this instinct matter bear revision? Won't almost any theory bear revision? To err is human, not to animal. Or so we pay the compliment to instinct that really takes away instead of gives. Our humour, conscientiousness and worship went long since to the dogs under the table and served us right for having instituted downward comparisons. As long on earth as our comparisons were stoutly upwards, with gods and angels we were men at least. But once our comparisons were yielded downwards into the mud and even dust, it was disillusion upon disillusion. We were lost piecemeal to the animals, like people thrown out to belay the wolves. Only our fallibility was left us, And this day's work makes even that seem doubtful. The impact that had on a pro-choice audience in Harvard was richly worth the risk. But it's true. And Frost's honesty is well worth learning, because people who are on the other side of the argument are absolutely appalled that Frost would be so honest. But he was. It does change our view of the world as a whole. So in Germany, they're serious about giving apes the equivalent of human rights. And many students in university today cannot make a clear distinction between human beings and animals. They don't look upon us as having any unique structure that they don't have, any unique characteristic that animals don't have. That's frightening. They're trying to be logical. Their belief system has led them to that point, and so they go on down that line. So justice went, the human rights movement grew, but it gets worse still. Certainly in emotional sense. As I've told you, I ended my clinical career looking after children with severe metabolic disorders, most of which were untreatable. One afternoon, a woman came in with a baby, a child, and she'd been crying, clearly. And I asked her what the problem was, and she said, "I came on the bus and a woman sitting opposite me looked at my baby," which to be kind to him would be to say he wasn't pretty, "and said, 'Why didn't you have that thing aborted?'" And I said to her, "That's terrible. I think I can help you a little bit to understand where she's almost certainly coming from. Because I suspect that woman is feeling a little guilt because she probably had an abortion for an essentially trivial reason. People have abortions because they booked a Caribbean holiday and they don't want a bump. Or it's inconvenient at this time. Or because they forgot to take their contraceptives. I mean, essentially trivial reasons if a human life is at stake. And then to see you pouring your life and your service into the care of that child, it was like a slap in the face to her." Which it was. That's our world. The common good is being eroded when we make bad choices. It is a package deal. You can't take the bit you want and leave everything else. It's a package deal. The common good has been eroded dramatically by abortion. Now, there are other consequences, much more factual. And these you need to know about too. The Scandinavians are constantly doing wonderful studies in their utopian socialist democracies to see that they're providing the best care possible to their citizens, given that they have economies that can support this. And they have done several studies. The one I'm quoting was done quite a while ago now, 20 years ago, 1997, in Act of Obstetrica Gynecologica Scandinavica, and it was a study of maternal mortality in the year after the delivery of a baby. What are the risks that a mother faces in the first year after the delivery of the baby? And it was a prospective study. Well done. Now, if you do a prospective study where you ask people to sign up to be part of a study of the needs of pregnant women, in our modern world, you do that a year or so before, what are you going to study as well as the birth of a baby? Abortion. They didn't think about that, but of course, that's inevitable, given the rates that we have. So they ended up with a very good study that compared the health risks of the woman who has the baby to the woman who has aborted the baby. Now, it turns out that it's easy to look at it because you can set the risk at 1 in every category for the woman who has the baby. It's increased in every category for the woman who has the abortion. Thus it reads like this. Total mortality in the following year, 1 for the baby, 3.53 risk for abortion. We think a 2-level risk is serious unless it's in these issues. Natural death, however, is only up 1 to 1.65. Accidents are up 1 to 4.24. Suicide is up 1 to 6.44, and the really stunning one is homicide, the risk of being murdered, which is up 13.99. nearly 1400%. What's going on? Well, don't make the mistake that evangelicals make so often of immediately jumping to the causation-correlation error. You can't prove that from that data. But what you can say, without any question whatsoever, is that that data is public domain, and what it does constitute is a huge duty of care laid upon the abortionist. These women are needy, but we cannot identify them until they ask for their abortion. Then, for the first time, they declare themselves. And they need huge care. Abortion clinics don't even keep their names. That's what we should be going after. I don't think it's a causal relationship. I think people who have abortions have had troubled lives already. It's part of a much deeper cultural problem than that. But it is, without any question, it gives you a duty of care. Now, for a long while in your country, it's no longer the case, but I think the media may be adjusting the data, and I'm not sure that all the surveys are true, but let me just take your state governments from 1967 to when this paper was published. At that point, the data I've got here stops at 1973, but it's enough to show you the state of affairs in the US. Bills to legalize abortion started in the 60s, early in the 60s, and were voted down 28 times without a single success in the state government. Arizona, Georgia, New York, Indiana, North Dakota, New Mexico, and New Jersey all did it right at the beginning, 67, voted it down. Iowa, Minnesota, Nevada, and Illinois, 1969. Vermont, Massachusetts, Washington, and New York State. Oh, New York State legalized it, sorry. 1970. 1971, Montana, New Mexico, Iowa. I don't need to go on. Virtually none of them voted it in because they are politicians. What's their only real concern? Getting re-elected. They actually have a very real interest in getting the data right at the level of how it's going to turn out in the polls. So that is what we have to think about. When you present it this way, it's astonishing what happens. You go on to the Casey decision and that famous Kennedy thing about everybody has their right to make their own view of the universe the one that dominates. I mean, that's subjectivism of a first order. But the real thing that's going on again is, as I said yesterday, the two worlds. Extrinsic rights versus intrinsic rights. Once you say that performance is what gives you your humanness, that's an extrinsic right. You have to earn it and you can lose it. Before that, we had an intrinsic right that everyone had. Which is the more democratic? That's a no-brainer. The self, severely damaged by this. When you find your mother had an abortion, you know that she had you expecting some sort of baby that she wanted. None of us live up to our parents' expectations anyway. It only gets worse with this. Animal rights, altered justice, loss of compassion, loss of meaning in suffering, loss of the common good. These have all been the logical and necessary results of abortion legislation. Now, I always end a lecture in the same way. The attention is complete usually at this time, and I say, look, I have laid out for you two worlds. Which one do you want to give to your children? And nobody moves. Because even the pro-choice people in the audience actually want the pro-life world for their children. On two occasions, I know that the girl who was running Medical Students for Choice sent an email around the medical school after this lecture. One in Wisconsin said, I've never heard it done this way. I have no idea what to say. Can anybody help me? The other one was in Iowa, where the pro-choice girl was in the front row, and she said, please come back. They've been sold a pup, and they they didn't realize it. They don't like it when they realize their position is philosophically untenable. And you don't have to have any emotion. You don't need any nasty pictures. That's not the way to make a case. This case is logical and theological. And we are people who have the needs which theology gives you answered, and which materialism and secularism can't. Enough, unless you have questions. I don't know how long I took to do that, but probably quite.
What you say will be taken down and used as evidence against you.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference between hospice care and physician-assisted suicide, and kind of where that fine line is, and versus the slippery slope of that.
I think it's going to come up tomorrow, isn't it? Euthanasia?
Yes.
So okay. I'll leave that one till then, if you don't mind.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Judge Bork has written extensively about
The
theory of jurisprudence, in which it's okay to sort of invent a legal argument as long as it achieves a beneficial social good.
Yeah.
Do you have any experience in defending the alternative view?
Yes. That's a good question. I mean, Bork's the greatest Supreme Court judge you never had. Even got to be a verb, didn't it, to be balked? How does one deal with the social activist judge? That's what you're talking about. That's the only version we have in Canada. And the issue, of course, is you need to talk about transcendence. They don't like it, but the way I do it when talking to medical audiences is to say in grand rounds, and of course there's some people coming in, getting their donut and their coffee and signing in, especially the Jewish physicians, not really listening. And then I say this: should you trust your doctor more or less if he believes in a transcendent God? And some Jewish physicians say, you're not saying I'm less of a doctor than my evangelical friends, are you? I said, no, I did not say that. I'm glad if you are an unbelieving Jew and you behave in a way which cannot be supported philosophically from your current standpoint, which is true. It's obvious and straightforward that if your doctor fears judgment after death, you should rationally trust him more. And the same applies to the judges. If judges are Darwinians and they believe that everything ultimately is a battle of the genes, then their gene pool is the one they care about most. They write laws that reflect the opinions of their peer group. They certainly don't go around asking working class people what they think about this. They wouldn't have made lots of decisions they had if they did that. So your question's a good one. I don't know the easy answer, except we need to talk much more, especially in medicine, about when a doctor can kill. This is your question. It's going to come up tomorrow more, but money changes hands, doesn't it, when people die? So there is inevitable corruption and conflict of interest the moment you give doctors the right to kill. You don't need to go to medical school for 10 years to do that. I think lawyers and politicians should do it. They could learn in 10 minutes. They would rescind the bill within 6 months. Any other questions? Yeah, comments are good. I can just sit back and listen. Oh, a full sheet.
I'm sorry?
A full sheet.
Well, it's in here somewhere. You made the point about the effect of the abortion on the woman herself.
Yes.
And I would advise anybody who's still doing clinical medicine to extend that to even men. Of course, men don't have abortions.
Well, that's where the murder comes from.
Well, their mothers may have had abortions. Mm. And does anyone remember Joycelyn Elders, the Clinton Attorney General?
Yeah.
Kind of unforgettable, actually. Well, she had this pet phrase that she Surgeon General, excuse me. She had this pet phrase that, to her, rationalized and defended abortions, which was every child a wanted child. And of course, I was pro-choice, pro-life, and I didn't really know how to retort that until I heard, and I still cannot remember his name, a psychiatrist from British Columbia. His first name's Philip, and I can't remember his last name. He's Christian.
Yeah, I know.
And I heard him at an APA convention. It happened to be the one in Toronto about 10 years ago. And he said he's done quite a bit of clinical research with people that have refractory anxiety disorders. And he finally had a breakthrough with many of these patients, men and women, when he discovered that hidden in their history, which he never obtained because he never asked the question, that their mothers had had abortions of course, potential siblings. And so I just ask you, can you imagine what kind of a question would arise in the mind of a child when he finds out that a sibling has been aborted by the mother who bore him? Yeah. What do you think would be the most likely question that would rise out of that, you know, distressing discovery?
What was Philip's... Did he have a nice...
To think about
did he have a nice phrase that you could remember to confront him? He's that kind of guy. I forgot his surname. I've got one of his books on my shelf.
I remember that he gave one that I could remember.
Okay, yeah.
But anyway, the point would be, getting back to Joyce and Elders, was, well, you know, what made me the wanted child? And that's all over our culture now. You know, the vast number of people whose families have been touched by this procedure. And the question can't be answered without great anxiety, because it's based on this extrinsic...
Yeah. What did I have to be and what am I expected to do? Yes.
Yeah. Or was it intrigue? I think I may have messed it up. But anyway. Yeah. And so... Then he began to have breakthroughs with these patients who he couldn't help with their anxiety until they realized that this tragedy that had happened in the family had completely undermined the trust in the parent-child relationship. It altered it, not in as obvious a way that the now adult could figure it out, but it had altered it nonetheless and had created this anxiety syndrome that then began to resolve once the truth came to the surface. Hmm.
That's David Ferguson's point from New Zealand too. Not a believer, but very well aware of the consequences of abortion in that way.
I would really encourage that the questions be open to any of the material that you...
Sure, yeah. If I can remember that far back, yeah. No, yeah, sure, go ahead.
So this is still about the abortion issue, but yeah. If you were giving this lecture to a church, would you do it the same way, or how would you potentially change it?
It's a good question, because astonishingly, I've had some of the more angry responses, not during, but afterwards, from churches. I think because I'd put a needle in their self-righteousness, in a way. There are a lot of, particularly in liberal churches, there are a lot of people who are very much in favor of more and more wanted baby type arguments, without wanting to have any data that shows, well, you need to think about that a bit more. But sadly, you're right, we've got a lot of stuff going on in our churches which is not open to discussion. Yeah. If you talk about sexuality in church.
Oh my gosh.
Although, that's changing. I was in Chile, the Argentine. I'd gone to the Uruguay ICMDA meeting, and one of my colleagues in Canada had been, I got to know quite well, and he came from Cordoba in the Argentine. When he saw I was going to be at the ICMDA meeting, he said, would you go to my church in Cordoba? I think they're ready for you. He comes from the same brethren sort of background as I did. A lot of brethren churches in the Argentine. And I said, sure, I'd be very happy. And he said, they'd love to have you for a week. So I went for a week to do a talk every evening. Wonderful translators, because lots of them had married English women. And I had a very nice translator. About two-thirds of the way through the week, I guess it was, I felt completely at ease, and I did something if you'd said to me, even a few years before, I could not dream of ever saying in a Brethren church it would be anything about sex. And I started to talk about sex very explicitly and about, I'll try and fit it in tomorrow at some point, but maybe I should do it now. I became convinced some years ago that the Catholics were right about contraception and that we need to repent. And that can easily be framed as a single question, and if you can stand up and answer it, then I don't have to back down yet. But I don't believe you can. Can you say to God, I want you to be in charge of all my life, which I hope you do in principle want to say, and then add, accept my fertility? No, you can't. You have to say, I want you to be in charge of all my life, except my fertility. Now, natural family planning allows you to get around that. A lot of people say, but it's still contraception, to which the response is then, why don't you use it? It is entirely different. I don't say anything about this. I usually ponder things for a year or two before I say anything. So it's some years ago since I first started talking about this to medical students in ICMDA, in CMDA meetings. It hasn't had the effect I expected. I thought, well, that's the end of my speaking career for CMDA. Not at all. In fact, if I go to a CMDA meeting, and it's a dinner meeting in the evening, and there's a couple there with a baby, I know what they're going to say. Because time and time and time again, I have young people having babies in residency or as medical students because they've listened to me. And no one has complained, and everyone has said thank you. The most beautiful example of this happened about 10 years ago. You remember there was a very horrible massacre at Virginia Tech. A student went berserk and killed 20-plus students. Now, the week before that happened, Sally, who tells me what I'm doing next all the while, she's the only person who does know what I'm doing next, said, you've got a week off next week, which is unusual in the spring. And she said, I wonder why. And the day after the massacre, a doctor from the DO school in Blacksburg, Thai, called me and said, we're being invaded by grief counsellors who really out of their depths. They're not helping us at all with a problem of this size. Are you by any chance free? Because you've certainly lived through a few disasters in your time. And I said, actually, I am. He said, get on the next plane. I'll buy the tickets. And so I went down. I gave several talks, one every day for about 5 days, I think. But I don't remember one of them, but I'm assured that it took place because it wasn't related to the week, but it must have been with medical students. And I was working my way through this, and I said, look, if God brings your spouse into your life while you're a medical student, get married and start a family. It's the best time to do it. Residency is a hard time to do it. If you wait longer, you might find you're not able to do it. No. Anyway, I don't remember that discussion, but I can imagine how it went. But about 3 years after the massacre, or 2 years after, Ty said, it's time you came to visit us again. I have a special Bible study group who want to meet you on their own. I said, what's special about it? He said, I'm not going to tell you, but come in on Thursday. When I got there, there were all couples, and there were 6 babies there. And they held me philosophically responsible for all 6. But no one was complaining. And of course, the medicine is not actually a difficult subject. And you get very anxious about exams and things. And a baby puts those anxieties into perspective. How many seconds after you get the baby in your hands after you get home does it take you to forget the day? I mean, that's what they do. And of course, they were all doing perfectly well. But the really interesting thing was, Ty said, the faculty can't get over this. These are the best years they've had in this medical school that any of them can remember. Because all the medical students pretty well like babies. And so it civilizes the whole class. Now, what's at stake here, it turns out to be much more than you realize at first sight. And the best way for you, and in your practice if you and in your church, there's a wonderful talk by Janet Smith called Contraception, Why Not? She's very clever, very smart, and a single woman. from a large Catholic family that is largely being disobedient to Catholic teaching, except for one. So she's funny and she's clever. Now, she has been saying, as I've been saying to my class for some years, that divorce is a very bad thing, but she is much smarter than me. She's been saying to her class for over 25 years, divorce is a very bad thing for you and your family, but if you will keep my four rules and you get divorced, I'll pay you $1,000. And she's never paid out. And now you all want to know what the four things are. It's lovely to do this in a liberal environment. And I slip off the topic for the night just to put this in, because I love doing it. And of course, girls who haven't said anything in public in their lives, when I say, I'm sorry, this is not tonight's lecture, I must move on, what do they say? Please, what are the four rules? And they're very interesting. I wouldn't have thought of the first one, which she puts there, but the more I think about it, the more I see the wisdom of it. She says, when you marry, the first thing you should do is establish a habit of giving away 10% of what the Lord has put into your hands during the year to people less well off than yourself or institutions that serve them. One of you will be much more materialistic than the other, and so the other will make the materialistic one a better person. And she's right. The next one is the obvious biblical one. Don't marry someone who doesn't share your faith position. And it needs to be said time and time again, because marriage is tough enough when you agree over the basics. Certainly Sally and I have often said we wouldn't have survived if we hadn't made a promise we intended to keep. That's essential. So that is off the table. It's not an option. The next one, of course, is no sex before marriage. But she's realistic. And she says, and this is where we in the church need to think about it more deeply, because youth pastors tell me no more than one in six evangelicals marrying are going to the altar virginal these days. I don't know. I don't have the basis for that number, but I guess it fits their experience. But she says, and I think this is why, she says, if you are sleeping together before you marry, stop for at least 2 years and see if you can love one another without sex. Because if you can't love one another without sex, you shouldn't marry. Because it's highly likely that sex is not going to be part of your relationship for considerable periods of time. It's the wrong reason to marry. It's one of the reasons to marry. I mean, the Anglican Communion Service has all three. Companionship, lust, and procreation. And that's what it's for. It has teleological purposes. The last one is funny. And practice natural family planning. She said, I know you're saying it's still contraception. Then why don't you do it? And then she very amusingly says, just imagine. You may think that your marriage is going to be wonderfully, romantically satisfying forever. Well, it won't be. And she says, after the bloom has gone off the rose, and you say to one another, we're not doing as well as we were, are we? And so you go on Expedia and you find a hotel you can afford, and you go away for a weekend to see if you can recapture the romance. And you get there, and then she says, you know what time of the month it is, darling, don't you? And because he has to know, I mean, the first thing that happens in this process is you learn about one another's sexual drives. And he says, how could we do that? And she said, well, you said we couldn't afford a baby. You said you weren't ready for a baby. Well, maybe I am. Well, I've had a race. Let's do it anyway. And of course, that's your baby. There are no surprise babies when you're using natural family planning. They can tell you when it happened to the minute. And does God know what he's doing is the basic question. And yes, he does, of course. But it's a lovely CD to have available in your church to couples who are looking at marriage. I mean, if you're a bit like us, well, I mean, we haven't been in that kind of church very much, but it to play it to people who are contemplating marriage and watch their faces, it's fun. You know, give them a dessert and coffee first, but it's a wonderful thing to do. But as I say, I get responses to this regularly, and I've never had a negative one. In our own family, the first two children married in the modern way, using technological means to solve a non-problem, is the way it is. The latter two didn't. Now, one has nine children, the other has five, but they're not complaining, and it isn't because of the methodology. It's because of being willing. I mean, when the mood is given to you by God, you're not going to resist. And of course, we're very happy to have 22 grandchildren. Yeah. Any other questions? You're loosening your tongues.
What's that?
I thought there were no questions, but once you get going.
So I view part of the abortion as, you know, like when I see abortion and then you know, selling of the
Yep.
parts. You know, I view that as evil.
Yeah.
And so have you? When you're trying to develop your thought processes about what should be done, does your does how you combat evil come into your thought process?
It's a good question. The way I see evil and the way they see it is quite different. In fact, they have no sustainable view of evil except in a utilitarian way. So I say to medical students, most of you are moral relativists. You believe there is no such thing as objective moral truth. The problem with that is that it destroys sin, because sin, by definition, is going against objective moral truth. But if you don't believe in it, you can't go against it. But nevertheless, I believe it to be real. And if I'm right, you are now in the situation where you have a major problem that you can't deal with because you don't have the intellectual means to do so. Because, of course, repentance makes no sense at all. And that's the way we go at it. God allows, particularly in this context, evil things to be done. I think it's Ezekiel 20. I always get the chapter, I usually get the chapter right, but not always. Ezekiel is talking to the children of Israel on God's behalf. And God is saying, you have not kept my laws, particularly the Sabbath laws. But then he goes on and he says, because of your disobedience, I have given you laws by which you cannot live. I have allowed you to sacrifice your children. I did it to horrify you, that you might learn that I am God. That is a pretty frightening passage. But you could look at our world at the moment and say that God might be doing that to us. We are being given laws by which we cannot live and we cannot flourish. And certainly God's permissive will is involved in that. And he's done it many times before. I mean, God is a utilitarian. We would be if we knew everything. There'd be nothing wrong with utilitarian ethics if we were righteous and we knew everything. Well, God does know everything, and he is righteous. And after all, he kills us all. When he thinks we've had long enough to make a right decision, or we're going to make bad ones, or I think many times when young Christians are taken away, it's because the devil is planning something absolutely horrendous, and God says, no. He's out of here. He's promised that he will not let go of us. But that's a promise that ought to make us shake a little bit more than we do. We have no fear of God nowadays, do we? No. And that's what it means. You know, play the Dies Iris from Verdi every week for a bit till you get some sense of what it's like. Yeah. And you're doing this for a holiday? I think we're through. Thank you.